Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Welcome to the Inside Lacrosse Division 3 Podcast. I'm Zach Babbo. Today I'm kind of taking a page from my colleague Terry Foy's book. I love the Reflex podcast he does for D1 every Monday. And I'm going to attempt kind of the similar thing for this weekend's D3 semifinal games. Cortland and RIT paired off in what apparently was a very exciting, kind of odd, head-scratching, atypical finish of a really great emerging Central New York rivalry. And down in the Maryland area, Stevenson held court against Salisbury and walked away 12-6 winners at a game I was at in a rivalry that has really kind of taken prominence in the Division III scene in the past maybe 5 years or so with all the back and forth that has gone on between those two teams. It's routinely one of the kind of bitterest, hardest hitting rivalries I see in any given year in the Division III ranks. So for starters, though, I want to jump out. I didn't get a chance to see the Cortland RIT game on Sunday, so we're going to talk to Dave Ramey. Dave is a longtime upstate New York reporter for the Central New York area. He's been kind of following along a lot of Central New York lacrosse all year for Inside Lacrosse, and he was down in Cortland covering the RIT Cortland game for InsideLacrosse.com. He saw RIT come out to a strong start just to see Cortland kind of prove their national champion merit and fight all the way back to push the game to overtime, and the final play kind of being decided by a very odd finish that most people don't get to see in a hidden ball trick. Anyway, Dave and I talked for a while, and he kind of called me up to speed on what wound up being, you know, for a guy who's seen a lot of lacrosse in his life, what seemed to be a pretty memorable game up in Cortland. Okay, well, the Inside Lacrosse Division 3 podcast now welcomes Dave Ramey. Dave's been the man in Central New York for us for a lot of this year, and Dave's been around a lot of lacrosse. He covered the RIT versus Cortland game yesterday. Dave, before we even get into what sounds like a pretty interesting, hectic game, particularly at the end, can you just kind of give me a feel for what the game was like in terms of, I was out at Stevenson Salisbury last night. They had a really big crowd, a great atmosphere. I know that, you know, Cortland and RIT, these two teams are fairly close to each other in Central New York, so, you know, it wouldn't be that hard for both teams to mobilize pretty good fan bases. Most schools are out, so there's not a lot of student body around necessarily, but you know, I've heard that you get a good crowd up there in Cortland for games before. I'm just curious if you can kind of let me know what the feel of the game was maybe in the early goings there.
Yeah, I would say that there were probably a couple thousand people there. I think they were pretty evenly divided. You know, it was the same situation that I witnessed when Syracuse played Bryan in the Division I first round, in the sense that, you know, it was kind of new to Bryan. Not that RIT hasn't been in the tournament before, but you know, they really had, they were louder. They had, I thought, a bigger student fan base. There was a lot of tailgating before the game. Cortland, their facility is unbelievable. The Jets, you know, use it to practice there now because, 10 or 12 years ago, they built this state-of-the-art. It's hard to describe, you know, the locker rooms, the field turf, the press box, the entire deal is great, and there's a lot of room to tailgate, and I thought it was, I don't think Cortland had much of a home field advantage, let's put it that way. I thought the RIT crowd was loud and excited, much like the Bryant crowd at the Syracuse game, and they really were into it right from the start. Of course, it didn't hurt that Bryant scored, you know, two goals in the first minute and change of the game to really take early charge of it, and that just got them even more juice. So it was a really great lacrosse atmosphere, probably because, you know, the knowledge that Cortland needed two overtimes to beat RIT earlier this season. They were involved in one goal games with RIT last year and the year before. So it's turned into a real kind of a non-conference rivalry. And I know that Steve Bevel, the Cortland coach, has tried to beef up, you know, the non-conference schedule. You'll notice they'll play just about anybody, you know, that's reasonable distance-wise in terms of non-conference. And now they have a great non-conference game really right in the neighborhood because RIT is located in Rochester, so it's an easy bus drive for both schools, and it's probably going to be a game that they're going to continue to play because RIT now has it going and really is the team to beat in the Liberty Conference. And of course, Cortland's been the team to beat in the SUNYAC for a long time. So it was just a great atmosphere on a cool, cloudy, overcast day that threatened to rain a lot, but never really did.
Well, it sounds like then, too, I mean, you know, this large group of RIT fans that made the trip out had a lot to get excited about, particularly in the early goings. You know, RIT builds up a 5-1 lead in the early parts of the game. Can you just, you know, take me through kind of that first half? What's going to be clicking so well for RIT to kind of jump out onto Cortland so early?
Absolutely. It was a strange lacrosse game because everyone expected, and of course the final score bore it out, but everyone expected it to be a back and forth, closely contested, evenly played game. And for 2.5 quarters, it was anything but that. RIT won every faceoff in the first half. RIT had a 24-7 ground ball advantage in the first half. Cortland, you know, they just looked like they had no interest in going back to the championship game. You know, they had a man up early in the game and just dropped, you know, two middies passing the ball back and forth up top before they got into their play. And, you know, middie drops a pass and RIT goes away with it. And there goes a 1 minute, you know, man up early. Cortland struggled mightily. RIT is a team that, you know, it's probably the kind of style that I would describe old fashioned Syracuse style, in the sense that they look for a lot of opportunities to create unsettled. They do it off the face-off. They'll gamble to press, and they press on defense a lot. They force out, and if you're not prepared for that onslaught, and you're not prepared to take advantage of the gaps that they give you by playing that style at both ends, you're going to get burned. And that's exactly what happened to Cortland early. I can remember at halftime, it was 5-1, and at that point, RIT had a 24-7 edge in ground balls, as I said, hadn't lost the faceoff. And I'm thinking, wow, this is supposed to be a close game. This is going to be a blowout. The thing is, it was only 5-1. So technically, Cortland was within, obviously, striking distance, but it didn't feel that way as you watched the game. And most of RIT's goals were really generated in that transition kind of style, unsettled, guys coming out of the box, you know, getting into the play, and Cortland was late getting into the play and leaving a guy open. So it was that kind of a 5-1 lead. They didn't score off of settled offense very much at all in the first half, if at all, but they still were absolutely dominating the game. And, you know, I was just like, wow, this is going to be pretty easy to write because it's going to be a blowout.
So then I guess, you know, what started to turn there in the third quarter that got Cortland back into the game, especially with Tyler Brooks-Lambert, it looks like, you know, having such a dominant day at the faceoff X, you know, generally.
Absolutely. And he won the first couple of the third quarter. Basically what happened is Cortland midfielder Joe Slavik, who's the SUNYAC player of the year, he finally decided to try to carry, you know, the team on his shoulders, and he's good enough to do that. Even though he's certainly not he will not remind anyone of Paul Rabel. He's 5'10" and weighs about 150 pounds, and that's probably soaking wet and before he's done his morning constitutional. I mean, he is a small player, but he really had a long pole on him, and he just said at that point in the game. I think Cortland fell behind 6-1, and he said, you know what, I have to do something. And maybe for the first time the entire game, someone decided to shoot low on Pat Johnston, the RIT goalie. Cortland spent the first half basically, if they got a prize for putting a shot into a goalie's stick without him having to move it, they would have gone home, with some nice country fair kind of stuffed animal, because that's all they did. Slavik decides, you know, hey, this is getting serious. He rifles in a low shot from about 12, 13 yards. He's pretty well defended. And then Cortland, started to make some stops in transition. And as you know, if a team's going to press and force transition, it's going to leave itself open for transition at the other end if you get a stop. And that's really how Cortland got back in the game. They started to score unsettled goals. They won a few faceoffs. They were like 3-for-7 in the third quarter and 4-for-7 in the fourth. So at least they evened that out, and they scored a couple goals off faceoffs. And I just, you're watching it, and they're like, is this really happening? Because all of a sudden, Mike Kaminsky, the fabulous Cortland goalies, you know, starts making some saves, and it's going the other way, and they decide to shoot low, and they start to score. And now, you know, they just creep back in, a lot like they did against Puffs last year in the same game when they were down like 5 goals in the third quarter and came back and won. So, I mean, it was just it wasn't that RIT started to play poorly. It was just that they had great opportunities in transition, but for whatever reason, the shots were wide. Kaminsky made a save. As a guy was about to shoot, he lost the ball, and it starts going the other way. And that's really how Cortland, climbed back in the game. If you look at the final score, it was 10-9. I would say there was 19 goals, and this is pure guess, but I would say 15 of them were scored in some kind of unsettled fashion. I really believe that very few goals the entire game were scored in settled offense. So that's how they got back into it.
So then I guess taking through the last 5 minutes, so I mean, Slavik scores a goal with about 7.5 left to tie it at 8. Then Eddie Kiesel gets one back to give RIT the lead with about 4 minutes left. And then, Cortland gets one more with about 2.5 left to tie it up again. I mean, I imagine that last 2.5 was fairly contentious in its own right, especially since either team looked like they were, you know, able to break out and score another transition goal, you know, on a whim almost, it sounds like.
Exactly, and it did. They each had back-and-forth chances. You know, after Cortland tied the score at 8, they went offside, and, flag was down, and RIT, a guy from way on the sideline, throws a pass into traffic, you know, towards the goal, towards the front of the crease, and I don't know. It's unbelievable. Again, it was a very strange game. This ball gets through 4 or 5 players to a guy wide open on the crease to put RIT back in front. And you're like, this is just meant to be. This is just RIT is going to win this game. And then, as you say, Cortland came back, tied it again, and then both teams had possession over the final couple minutes. And Cortland finally gets possession with about a minute to play. Now RIT goes offsides trying to get back and unsettled. And this is where the game, as someone who's watching it and has watched the game for a long time, gets really, really kind of strange. And if you want to be a second guesser, here you go. You've got a golden opportunity. You know, that's not my thing. I'm just a dumb sports writer. I try not to second guess coaches who get paid, you know, to do their job. But with 51 seconds left, the flag goes down. Cortland gets the ball into the RIT zone. And they just kind of like passing it around. And I'm thinking, well, you know what? They're going to wait till it gets to about 30 before they take a shot. And then if it gets saved or whatever, you know, they'll have the man up. But here, I think that Steve Bevel was so concerned about his team's struggles at the faceoff X that that's why he decided to do that rather than just, hey, go to the goal. Go hard. Let's go. You know, the flag's down. Let's see if we can steal one before we even get the penalty. The thing that was strange to me was he waited till there were 17 seconds, not 30. He waited till there were 17 seconds left to call the timeout. And here's the deal. And I didn't ask him about this afterwards, and shame on me for not doing it. But there were so many other crazy things that happened, I just forgot. You know, he decides to wait till 17 seconds, and I think his strategy was, if we don't score, I want to have the ball in overtime, because if we don't score, they're going to win the faceoff. RIT's going to win the faceoff, and I could lose this game in overtime. So he calls a timeout with 17 left, And again, I'm trying to read his mind here. I think he's telling his players at that point, hey, go ahead. If you get a good look, take it, but do not let the goalie make the save. If you're going to miss, I want you shooting for corners and I want you missing wide. So we back it up and we retain possession. And that's exactly what happened. They got two good looks in those final 17 seconds. Each shot was wide. Each shot was backed up. And so they retained possession. Clock winds out. They're going to overtime, but Cortland now has the ball in overtime. They get one good shot off in that remaining 13 seconds of the man up. Another wide shot. They back it up. Now he calls timeout and sets up their play in overtime. And Mike Cummings, one of their midfielders, actually had a really good look from right up top at about 12 yards. He had enough time to wind up, at least he thought so. But by the time he got the shot off, an RIP defender came streaking out. He clunks this rocket right off the kid's head, and the ball could have gone in a lot of different directions. Instead, it goes right off. It almost makes a 45 degree right to the kid's left towards the RIP sideline, where Cody Council, the Cortland attackman, is in perfect position to run this ground ball, you know, down, shot down, keep possession, and get it going again. Well, unfortunately for Cody, he runs over. There's not an RIC player within 10 yards of him as it's rolling out of bounds. He steps over the line before the ball does. And anybody who's coached the game or played the game knows that it's the closest man to the ball inbounds. And I've seen guys go out of bounds a lot and referees just give them the ball anyway. But in this case, it was so blatant and it was right in front of the RIT bench that they gave the ball to RIT. So that's what set up the eventual, game-winning goal for the Tigers. And, you know, they went down and they took a really bad shot, in my opinion. And after they called the timeout, they took a bad shot. They get the ball back. They backed it up. And then they play, there's like nine Canadians on this roster, and they play that style. If you didn't know better, you'd think you were watching a box lacrosse game. There's a lot of fake pass flips, you know, between midfielders. The one guy who doesn't have the ball starts running to the cage and, you know, like he's dodging and stuff. They had tried it a couple times earlier in the game and it didn't work. This time they do try it again. And, the one midfielder flips the ball. That would be number 11, who was Taylor Wisman. He flips the ball to Alistair Warren. Everybody from Cortland knows it except Mike Kaminsky. So Wisman now, he starts driving down the alley, you know, like he's got the ball, switching hands with his stick and whatever. And Wisman is going the other way, kind of off Kaminsky's left, but Kaminsky followed the guy who didn't have the ball. And number 24, let me get my stats. Sorry about this.
I think it's
number
Alistair
24,
Warren.
Alistair Warren,
yeah.
The sophomore midfielder from Toronto. He just basically lobbed a shot off to the side of Kaminsky. And it was surreal to see this floater against an All-American goalie, against a four-year starter, against a second-team All-American, kind of just float past them and into the net. And it was a strange way to end a very strange game. And I've seen lots of lacrosse in my life, and that was weird in an NCAA semifinal. Really was.
I guess, Dave, you know, for you, I mean, who would maybe be the player of the game in this one? Is it somebody like a Pat Johnson for you know, getting the assist and also 10 saves, keeping his game in it, keeping his team in it, rather? Is it a guy like Alistair Warren for scoring the game winner, or maybe Brooks Lambert for dominating the faceoff X? Or maybe is it a guy like Joe Slavik who, you know, despite the loss, kind of strapped his team on his back and showed that, you know, he is a legit contender, if not probably the front runner for, you know, Midi of the Year conversation?
Yeah, you just named a bunch of guys who would be worthy of it. I would say the player of the game, in my opinion, was the guy at the X, because that they scored so much off of unsettled, that was the that he was the key. And even, you know, even though Cortland did better in the second half, I think he finished 15 for 21. And anybody who follows this game knows that 15 for 21, if teams are evenly matched everywhere else on the field, and I think these teams are, 15 for 21 is usually the deciding factor, you know. And I would absolutely say that was the case. Not only was he 15 for 21, he never coughed it up. You know, Cortland tried a lot of things against them. You know, they said, well, let's just go after them and ride them, and that just created transition. So I would say that the, you know, that old number one there, Brooks, you know, Tyler Brooks Lambert, yeah, would be my player of the game.
All right, well, I mean, that sounds like it was a hell of a game to watch, Dave. So I'm a little jealous. I mean, it was fun to see Stevenson Salisbury, but it didn't quite have the high drama and trickery and kind of head scratchingness that RIT Cortland seemed to have for you yesterday. So and it looks like there'll be a lot of buzz up in Central New York this weekend now, as you have RIT in the D3 championship and Syracuse and Cortland both in the D1 Final Four now.
Yeah. Yeah, it's going to be great. I mean, it could have been one of those years where, you know, where I was looking at, you know, I guess in 2008 or so, or I forget what year it was, where we had, you know, OC Onondaga win the junior college title, and then you had, you know, Cortland and Lemoyne and Syracuse in the championship game, and it looked like that magic was going to repeat. And if you had told me that early this season, If you'd have named, obviously Onondaga is in a class by itself right now in JUCO, but if you had looked at Syracuse in Division I based on what I saw and what I've seen all year in Syracuse, and you had looked at Lemoyne in Division II, and you had looked at Cortland in Division III, and you said, pick one of those teams to play in the championship game, you know, and you know, a vacation to Florida is on the line here, I would have absolutely taken Cortland, and that's the one team that's not in the championship game. So, funny game, my friend. It's a funny game.
Well, at least you don't have to worry about leaving Central New York for Florida next winter now, I guess.
That's right.
All right, well, Dave, thanks a lot for coming on and fill me in a bit on this game here, and you know, enjoy the upcoming fun weekend, it sounds like, to be a lacrosse fan in Central New York.
It should be anywhere near as strange as yesterday's game was, people are going to be scratching their heads.
So RIT comes out of the north, taking that side of the bracket spot in Philly for the D3 championship this weekend. I was up in Stevenson last night for the Stevenson-Salisbury game, where the Mustangs came out representing the South this year, kind of taking the spot that Salisbury typically does in another chapter of what's really become just a fantastic rivalry. I'm going to be joined shortly here by Sean Nissen of the Daily Times of Salisbury to kind of talk about the overall season arc that Salisbury had, because, you know, it was kind of an interesting year for them in terms of how much they graduated and yet still how much they were able to get done. Maybe not that surprising knowing the pedigree of the program that Salisbury has, but nonetheless, you know, I think a nod needs to be given there, and you always kind of want to follow the story of the defending national champion as kind of they go through the next year. And Ed Lee will also be joining me, the Baltimore Sun. Ed catches a lot of lacrosse in the Baltimore area, and he has checked in a couple of times on the Stevenson program. And Ed and I kind of run into each other in the boxes. We like to talk shop from time to time. So I really wanted to have Ed on to discuss, you know, last night's game with me. So first we'll hear from Ed. Then we're going to check in with post-game comments from last night's post-game press conferences with first Stevenson coach Paul Cantabene, kind of giving his thoughts on this season for his team and really what this win meant. And then Jim Berkman kind of giving his usual, you know, kind of stoic, motivating speech to his team of, you know, you get the idea of the bar of success being set at Salisbury very high from the remarks that that Coach Berkman kind of shared with his team to motivate them heading into the offseason. Okay, the Inside Lacrosse Division III podcast now welcomes on the Baltimore Sun's Ed Lee. Ed's kind of the man about Baltimore for lacrosse here. He covers pretty much all things Maryland lacrosse, at least that I like to read in the paper anyway. And does a damn good job of it, I must say, too. And I get the privilege of running into Ed in a lot of press boxes in the area. Ed was in the same press box with me in Mustang Stadium last night for Stevenson's big 12-6 win over Salisbury to advance the Division III championship game. Ed, before we even get into the game, I was talking to Dave Ramey before about the RIT-Cortland game, and he kind of painted this very kind of festive almost scene in Cortland surrounding that game. You know, last night we were there. There were 2,300-plus, I believe, in Mustang Stadium for the largest lacrosse crowd in Stevenson. You know, what was your kind of sense of just, you know, the atmosphere and all that for a big time semifinal game under the lights in this stadium?
Well, I'll tell you, when I pulled into the parking lot before the game, I had never seen so many cars already there. You know, usually I can get there 30 minutes before the game and find plenty of parking and, you know, basically just pull into any spot. But, you know, it was almost near capacity at that point. So, I just thought it was a great showing. You know, obviously it's two teams with quite a bit of history with each other, and you can tell that, you know, particularly in the Stevenson community and Salisbury community, you know, this meant a lot to them. So it was nice to see that, you know, even though there are no Division I schools from Maryland represented in the NCAA tournament, that there was still some support for the D3 schools in their tournament.
Yeah, I was pretty impressed. I mean, especially a Sunday night and everything. And I mean, the crowd even though it was a little bit smaller than College Park, obviously different stadium and everything, but to me it felt a bit more active and festive than the College Park crew. But maybe part of that is almost also this rivalry. I mean, did you have any thoughts going into this game on how this one might play out, particularly, you know, even the differing seasons these two teams have had, but even beyond that, I mean, just the deep-seated history almost of this rivalry. I mean, this game has probably been one of the better ones in the past 5 years or so, but you watch it and it almost sometimes has the feeling of two teams that have hated each other for 50 years or something. I mean, what are your kind of, you know, what were you thinking heading into this one?
Yeah, you know, I have to be honest. I was not optimistic about Stevenson's chances of winning simply because, and I think you and I discussed this before, that, you know, Salisbury has such a rich history of sort of defying the odds. And certainly getting to even the national semifinal was something that was unexpected for this team. A lot of people thought that this was the year that, you know, Salisbury would drop to the rest of the, the proletariat and not be as good. And they sort of stunned observers by even getting to the national semifinal. But, you know, I thought that, you know, Stevenson has, you know, sort of this kind of like mental block about beating Salisbury. I mean, I know they beat them early in the year, but, you know, when they came to a pressure-type situation in the NCAA tournament where it's basically one and done, could they actually live up to the expectations? And so, you know, they surprised me with the way they played last night. I thought for some reason at some point Salisbury was going to make a run and eventually get back into it. But they didn't. You know, it was just Stevenson just being too good.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Stevenson jumps out to this early lead. They build a 5-1 lead, a 9-3 halftime lead, and then kind of what you said, you know, I mean, I think everybody was kind of waiting to see if Salisbury would come back into it. And while the second half was definitely more helter-skelter and there were opportunities for Salisbury to maybe get back, you know, they just couldn't seem to get back into it. I mean, you know, first on the Stevenson side of it, I mean, what do you think really helped contribute to the overall success they had on the night, from starting so strong to, you know, being able to close it out even as the game kind of descended into a bit more chaotic play in the end?
Well, I think it certainly helped that they got out to a big lead. I mean, once you get out to a lead of 9-3, you know, there's a certain comfort level there. You know, they don't have to grip onto their sticks as tight. They figure they feel more confident about what they're running offensively and defensively as well. In the second half, you know, I think also the defense played much better. You know, they only gave up, I think, 3 goals in the entire second half to a Salisbury unit that was pressing a little bit. You know, obviously they wanted to get the ball, they wanted to get possessions, and they wanted, you know, take opportunities. But I think the fact that the defense played what you would expect from Stevenson, because, you know, you needed that kind of performance for Stevenson to beat Salisbury and get to the title game. So, yeah, I think it's a combination of getting up that lead and then having the defense play as well as it did in the second half.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, what does almost feel like the real success or strength of the Stevenson team is right now? I mean, you know, I've heard all year people talk about, you know, it almost seems to be game to game. It's either what a great defense they have, what a great offense have. I mean, to me, I was impressed last night both in how the defense was able to really just shut the gate through the second half there, despite the opportunities Salisbury had to get back into it. But on top of that, too, I mean, this is a Salisbury team, or rather a Stevenson team, that routinely takes, you know, 50-plus shots a game, and they just wing it, and they're not always that discerning of choices. And last night almost seemed a more reserved offense from them in terms of, you know, 39 total shots, you know, a lot of really good shots, too. I mean, you figure that, you know, they score 12 goals, Salisbury has 9 saves, that's 21 shots that were on Cage. You know, that out of 39, I mean, that's better than 50% for a team that typically shoots something below 30%. You know, is there a maturation on offense? I mean, where do you think the strength of this team lies, or maybe is the strength that they just seem to be really playing well from end to end at this point?
Well, I think if you'd asked me, for basically a season view, I would have said that defense has been sort of the foundation of this team. And, you know, I talked with Paul Kibbeni about it, and he talked about how, you know, as much as people tend to think that Stevenson is this sort of offensive juggernaut, they really pride themselves on their defense and the fact that they have a defense that can extend, that can apply pressure and force opposing offenses into turnovers. But I think last night was really just an illustration of how good they were all around. Like I said, I think the offense was sort of the highlight in the first half, and the way they were efficient in terms of, you know, getting opportunities and canning those opportunities when they had them. And then in the second half, it was the defense that sort of finished what the offense had started. I was especially impressed with the defensive midfield. I mean, Eric Klug didn't have a goal. I think Tyler Smith maybe had one or two. But Greg Corbin didn't. I don't think he had a goal. He may have had an assist or something like that. But I was really impressed with the way the defensive midfield played, because, you know, obviously that's sort of the area where you're going to attack any defense. And Dimitri Bakunas, I mean, the way he played, I mean, that's what you sort of expected from him. And you had some concerns when he got pulled in that game against Washington College, but the way that he's played in the last two games, I think I think a lot of his teammates and the coaches, a lot of the confidence that they had in this game against RIT.
And then I guess, you know, on the other side of it, I mean, what maybe did Salisbury seem to struggle with so much last night? I mean, they didn't do terribly in the face-off battle, but they did. You know, they didn't do great either, considering the kind of regard that everyone has for Tyler Granelli. And you know, on top of that, I mean, they dig the big hole early. And Berkman even kind of alluded to it in his post-game press conference of, you know, that they got looks in the second half, and it wasn't a particularly good day shooting for Salisbury in their own right.
Mm-hmm.
But,
mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, it seems to be one of the things they struggled with all year was kind of getting into rhythms offensively. And I mean, you know, obviously Stevenson's got a really good goal or a really good defense generally. But, you know, you tend to expect a team like Salisbury to put up more than 6. And even if you go back into the season, you saw a lot of games where Salisbury was only putting up maybe, you know, single digits. I mean, what did it seem to you that really was kind of the real struggles of Salisbury last night?
Well, I think Salisbury sort of mirrors Stevenson a little bit in terms of the defense is the foundation for both of these teams. But unlike Stevenson, Salisbury has had a season-long problem of generating offense. And you saw that crop up again last night. I mean, you know, they had not as many possessions as you would have thought. And when they did have those possessions, they were either taking shots that were just way off target and you know, going, you know, way wide of the net, or they were, you know, committing turnovers. And I think, you know, Jim Berkman even pointed that out last night after the game, that at one point their star player, you know, had 3 straight turnovers at the end of the second quarter. So I think the offense, I think, you know, they just didn't get into a flow. You know, they weren't getting opportunities. They were trying to dodge, and they just weren't able to do anything against Siemens defense. And then when they did, yeah, they were off target and they were committing turnovers. And those two things are things that are going to kill the offense when you're trying to, you know, dig yourself out of a hole.
And then, you know, I mean, at the end of the game, obviously Stevenson's kind of protecting that late lead. Salisbury is trying to make plays happen. And on top of that, you know, maybe getting a little frustrated. You know, we mm-hmm. saw some of the typical, you know, no love loss kind of a chippiness that occasionally comes out in this series. I mean, what'd you think of that? Just the tenor of these games and last night in particular, how it falls into this series of how, you know, these teams really, you know, they don't relent an inch to each other. They always try and get that extra little jab in there if they can. I mean, I guess I kind of expected that almost down the stretch, regardless of what the score was or not. You know, just thoughts on maybe the intensity level of this game and this rivalry.
Yeah, you know, I guess I was a little bit surprised that it didn't get as hostile as I thought it would. I thought that, okay, now that Stevenson has a lead, you know, maybe Salisbury's going to let the frustration get the best of them. And, you know, there was a little bit of chippiness that we saw towards the end of the game. But I was very surprised at the fact that Stevenson didn't retaliate, you know, and I think, you know, Paul Kinsey-Bennett mentioned it, that they, as a program, they have matured to the point where, you know, they know that they're at a level where they have to maintain a certain level of execution and a certain level of composure. And, you know, that's what the great programs do. That's what the programs that win national championships do. And so, you know, he's trying to get his program to that level. And you know, if they're going to, you know, be national championship worthy, they have to show a certain, you know, decorum, you know, when they're out there on the field. And I think what you saw yesterday was a good indication of that. Now, you know, can they carry that on? You know, and how would they react if, you know, they're trailing, you know, late in the game in a national championship game? That'll be the ultimate test to see how far this program has come along.
And, you know, I guess with that in mind, it kind of leads to, you know, I mean, almost the obvious wrap-up of this almost is, you know, you've been in the Baltimore area for a while. You've gotten to kind of see this Stevenson program, you know, kind of come to form. I mean, first, you know, what does last night's win maybe kind of mean in terms of a benchmark or, you know, kind of that maturation process? And then, you know, a step beyond that even of, you know, what do you think it would mean if Stevenson is able to capture their first, Division III title here?
Well, it's certainly a breakthrough for this program. You know, they've been to the national semifinals, I believe it was three times, lost all three times. So for them, this was significant to get to this stage in the NCAA tournament, to have the opportunity to play for a national title. And certainly that's not going to be lost on the players and the coaches and administration and basically the entire program. But I think you got the sense last night that the players weren't just satisfied. They weren't content with this. They want to move on. They want to, you know, get that national title, and they want to beat RIT if they're going to have to do that. And I think that would be a monumental step for this program. And, you know, truth be told, you know, this is the prime opportunity for them to do that. You know, you don't get a chance that often to get to this stage and to say that, you know, you're competing for a national championship and, you know, that you actually want it. So, you know, I think this is a grand opportunity for them, and it's one that they certainly must take full advantage of.
All right, well, Ed, thanks a lot for, you know, kind of coming on and talking the game with me last night. As always, it was fun to run into you in the press box, and I'm glad to know I'll get one more chance to bump into you here before the season's out, as well, I'll sure cross paths up in Philly this coming weekend. As always, your analysis is appreciated. I recommend everybody keep reading, you know, Ed Lee and the Baltimore Sun, and generally keep reading papers like the Baltimore Sun. Those mid-market papers are definitely the heart of journalism in America, in my opinion, but, you know. But anyway, Ed, thanks a lot for coming on. And have safe travels. I'll see you up in Philly.
Absolutely. Thank you, Zach.
Take care.
Coach, if you could just open up with an opening statement for
us. Yeah, sure. No problem. I just want to congratulate Salisbury University. I thought Coach Berkman did just a tremendous job with this team to get them back to the championship game. We've always been so impressed with his team and how he is able to get them here every year, if not farther. And it's got to be one of his better coaching jobs. I thought he did a great job. And congratulations to them on a fine season. I also like to thank everybody at Stevenson University, who's just such a support, such a family here. And, you know, it's not just a lacrosse team. Everybody chips in and helps. And just showing this weekend with the D2 and the D3 thing going on with the women's. And they have here this game here and the biggest crowd in school history here. And for all that going on, you know, I really tip my cap to them and thank President Manning and Brett Adams for everything they've done for us. And, you know, I think it's a great accomplishment for us. On top of that, you know, this is something that, as a coach, you know, when I first took over at Stevenson University, my first year, when you're practicing on a slanted practice field and your ADs are moving rocks from the field and everything like that, yet you never think that these moments would be possible. And it's just kind of a miracle that I'm even sitting here talking to you and going to this game. And, you know, these guys to my left and my right are the big reasons we're doing this, and all the alumni beforehand. And I just want to say thanks, fellas. Great job on the alumni. And, you know, we're looking forward to playing for a week from now.
Coach, he is a
I guess I don't know how much you want to share, but just the maybe what you dress the team with at the end of the year or at the end of this game today. I mean, I saw the big huddle. This, you know, this has kind of been an interesting run for you guys this year, I guess, compared to history. Is there any kind of perspective you could lend after the game? Or?
Well, I said the same thing to them, and I said, you know, in 2006 when we lost the national championship game in overtime, I said, hey, look over at the other side right now. It's not a very good feeling, is it, right now? You know, let's learn a little bit about this moment. Let's use it as motivation, you know, to get us out the door a little bit more maybe than we have in the past year to get done what we need to do. And, you know, when we get this moment again next year, hopefully we're a little bit better prepared and we can seize that moment. Very proud of you and what you've accomplished, especially in this run on the road. And we got a lot to look forward to because we have a great nucleus returning, you know, in 2014.
Okay, now kind of in an effort to maybe recap some Salisbury season, because I think it's worth, you know, talking about this interesting year for defending national champion. They had a lot of guys leave, a lot of new guys step up, kind of an up and down year for Salisbury. I have on Sean Nissen from the Daily Times based out of Salisbury. Sean's been following this team for most of the year. You know, Sean, kind of a disappointing end, I guess, to the Salisbury season last night in terms of losing in the semifinal game. But in other terms, you can maybe look at it, and for any other program, maybe this would be looked at as a positive year, considering how much Salisbury lost and how far they were still able to get in all this. I mean, what maybe your thoughts, kind of, you know, especially now a day removed from the loss, you know, of what the season was for Salisbury.
Zach, I've really been struggling with that question in my own head because I added it up before the season, and Salisbury lost 12 of their top 15 scorers from the undefeated national championship team in 2012. They lost 510 points from those 12 players. That is just an absolutely ridiculous number of points. To put that in perspective, the team as a whole this year only scored 429 points. So, I mean, that's just amazing, the amount of talent that they lost in the Sam Bradmans, the McEnonies, and those type of players from last year's championship team. So to see this team get as far as they did to make it to the Final Four, I personally consider that a success. But when you've won 10 national titles, 7 out of the last 10 that have already been decided, you know, when you don't come away with another championship, another ring, I'm sure Berkman is not necessarily, you know, happy or satisfied, but he's got to be pretty pleased with how this team performed throughout the year. They really came together down the stretch. You know, after that loss to Washington and the War on the Shore, and then kind of a surprising loss in the CAC finals to St. Mary's, they really played well on the road in the playoffs before the game at Stevenson last night. Last night was definitely a disappointing effort all around. Got off to a wacky start with that first goal that they scored against Alex Taylor. I don't think I've ever seen AT make a play like that before. But they've got to be encouraged because all of their scores from last night, Brady DeShield, Ty Smith, Rhett DePaul, and Greg Corbin, they'll all be back next year. And I think the highlight of this season has really been the development of Brady DeShield. Freshman kid, local kid out of Salisbury, went to Parkside High School, literally right around the corner from Salisbury University, and he really stepped up. Got off to kind of a slow start, but his minutes really increased, got bumped up to the first line attack about halfway through the season, and he just shined. He is definitely going to be a player to watch in the coming years. You know, when you get that much time playing at Salisbury as a freshman, you know how good of a player you're expected to be, you know, your sophomore, your junior, your senior year. So there's definitely a lot to look forward to for Salisbury. It'll also be interesting to see, personally for me, this team also lost senior Ryan Clark. He was supposed to be one of their big weapons. He was a returning All-American. This was his senior year, but he tore his 5 games into the season. So, you know, it'll be interesting to see whether he applies for a medical redshirt year and if he's granted one and gets to come back for another season. It was a really interesting year. I think Salisbury should be happy with how they played, but, you know, they're not satisfied today. You know, this is going to gnaw at them. And, you know, honestly, that's probably only going to make them better and more dangerous next year. That they were denied this championship, they're only going to want it even more next year.
You know, you mentioned the Ryan Clark injury, and that kind of seems an interesting one to me, particularly for this year for Salisbury, because Clark was such a focal point for the team going into this year. He was in conversations for Midi of the Year, Player of the Year. He was a supremely talented player. And part of what I heard, and we also mentioned the kind of difficulties that Salisbury had on offense for portions of this year, and kind of how it took time for other guys to emerge. And that was kind of one of the diagnoses I heard for some of the problems Salisbury had, was that, so much in the early part of the season, it was almost like at times the team was kind of looking at Clark to make plays, and other guys weren't really kind of finding their role within the offense yet. And obviously Clark goes down, and then there's going to be a little bit of an adjustment of having to try and figure out, how to make up for that. And you can see there's a string there in the middle of the season where the team is scoring fewer than double digits routinely. And can you talk about maybe that the way, Coach Berkman alluded to it in his press conference last night of how, once they kind of got that attack set of Rabishaw and DePaul and DeShiel, that they started to actually coalesce a little bit more and become more of a unit and produce. I mean, how did that evolution go maybe this year, and how much did that kind of tie into the troubles that Salisbury had or the success that they had too up and down?
I think that was a huge factor, because you look at Berkman's teams traditionally, they're based around a star player. Kyler Berkman was, the player of the year for I believe 2 years in a row. And, Sam Bradman follows him as another two-time player of the year. And Ryan Clark, he was going to be that playmaker for Salisbury this year. He was going to be that difference maker. And when he went down, it just left a huge hole in the Salisbury offense that they weren't really able to recover from. Rhett DePaul later on in the season was able to step up, and he did a great job behind the cage, feeding people and making things happen. But that really was a huge loss for Salisbury that they couldn't foresee. I mean, you don't think that somebody's going to get injured. You can't really plan for that. But that kind of spoke to the lack of depth on this team as well. There weren't a lot of scores. Salisbury had, throughout the season, I was there for eight of their 23 games or whatever it was, and, they had open net to hit, but they just missed. You don't see that a lot. And Berkman consistently throughout the season always mentioned on how they were working on shooting in practice more than he ever had before in any year at Salisbury for him. So it really was a struggle to score. I mean, you look at a May 10th or a March 10th game against Ohio Wesleyan at home, for instance, the Seagulls won that game 4-3. I mean, that shouldn't happen. I mean, that game is a 15-3 game any other year than this year. That being said, the offense did grow. The loss of Ryan Clark forced this offense to grow and learn, and, it'll probably be better off down the line because of those situations. It wasn't easy for Salisbury at all this year, A lot of the years, it's easy. The past 2 years especially, the back-to-back national championship teams, I mean, they cruised. They stepped on the field. They knew that they were better than anybody that they saw. And, there was one or two games where they actually had to, put forth the maximum effort and make sure they were dialed in and performed at a high level. This year, is a struggle for Salisbury, which was interesting to see, because you don't often get to say that about a program like Salisbury University.
You kind of mentioned that struggle, and this was a really kind of interesting year, unique year for Salisbury, and kind of the ebb and flow of the season. I wrote something that went on our site today, and Salisbury graduated a lot, and people knew they weren't necessarily going to be as good this year, but they were still picked to be within, probably the top two, three in the nation. They start the year, that they smoke Greensboro, which, you expect, but then they drop to Lynchburg, they drop a one-goal decision to Washington and Lee, then they rattle off, it's eight or nine straight, and then drop the game to Stevenson, which was, probably in this year more or less to be expected with how good Stevenson looked. And then, they get back together, and then they lose the WAC game for the first time in a long time. The War at the Shore has really been dominated by Salisbury for probably about the past 10 years. And then, you know, they get into conference tournament time and they're back in the CAC championship like always. And you kind of figure, you know, that's the given. That's how Salisbury makes the playoffs. They take the CAC AQ and lo and behold, St. Mary's upsets them. And now suddenly they're a Pool C team. But then they get into the Pool C conversation and they get a Pool C bid easily and then roll through the playoffs until Stevenson, you know, crushing Susquehanna, beating Washington and Lee. You know, getting some vengeance there, upsetting the number one seed in the South, Dickinson, in a game where they were down by four, I think, at one point, and came back. You know, and then eventually the loss last night to Stevenson. I mean, you know, what can you take away from kind of the arc of a season like that? That kind of up and down. You know, to have some big losses, to get back to form. You know, to me the game that really jumps out is that CAC game. You don't see Salisbury lose the CAC AQ very often, if at all. You know, what do you kind of think of the arc or the way the season played out?
You know, that was also interesting to watch. I thought so too. You know, before the year, just looking at how much they lost, you figured that this was going to be a quote unquote down year for Salisbury, where they lose four or five games. So, you know, in my personal opinion, before the season, that's what I had them at, four or five losses. You know, they end up with six. You know, so that's a down year. You know, they make it to the Final Four. It's a down year, quote unquote, for Salisbury. But it's really not. I mean, you just look at all that they overcame, and it was a lot of struggle. It was a lot of hardship, but they were able to make something out of it. You know, if you would have told Berkman before the season that they would make it to the Final Four, I think that he probably would have signed off on that and been okay with it. You know, they have pretty much everybody coming back. They lose Tyler Grinnelli, who's, you know, an All-American face-off guy. But he, you know, he wasn't as good as he was last year, in my opinion, this year. They lose Eric Klug, who was a solid attackman, but he had more or less one move where he crashes towards the crease and, you know, rips the shot. Solid, you know, he had tons of goals, but one-dimensional, more or less. And then, you know, they lose a guy like Brett Baer, who's a solid long stick defenseman. But they have, you know, a lot of guys in the bullpen who can step up and fill those positions. I come back to Brady DeShiel and his development, and you just expect him, or Salisbury is probably going to lean on him to take another leap forward next year and really be, you know, one of those star type caliber players that Salisbury has depended on in the past. You know, you look at the emergence of Jesse Rabishaw, who really came on late in the season. He got some playing time. It'll be interesting to see how he performs next year, because Berkman told me he was the 15th attackman out of 15 on the roster, and he made his way all the way up. I mean, this was kind of an interesting season for Salisbury, just because there were so many questions surrounding, you know, who was where and what was going on. So things should be more settled going into next year. They had Alex Taylor coming back in the cage. He's a great, great goalie. He had a terrible night last night. The Stevenson keeper completely outplayed him. Stevenson's keeper last night made, I thought, five or six just phenomenal saves. And Alex is normally the one to provide those for Salisbury, but I thought he gave up a handful of pretty soft goals last night. He even said during himself, during the post-game press conference, said he wasn't seeing the ball very well. So, you know, those things will happen. You know, it doesn't happen to Salisbury very often, especially in the playoffs. But I think Salisbury will be stronger going forward next year because of all the adversity that they faced this year, the people that were forced to step up into roles that they had to kind of grow into and learn. And, you know, you really do grow a lot more when you're tested, when there's pushback. So I expect great things from Salisbury. I wrote in an article that will be on DeMarvinNow.com tomorrow that Salisbury should be right back up at the top of the D3 mountain next year with all that they have returning, and I'm sure all of the great recruits that Berkman will bring in over the offseason.
Yeah, and I loved Berkman's comments after the game last night of, you know, kind of making his team sit there and watch Stevenson celebrate and say, you know, doesn't feel too good to watch that, boys, does it? That we want that to be us next year. It seems that seems very classic Jim Berkman there, and kind of rubbing that in a little bit to make sure the salt that is in the wound for when guys are, you know, getting ready and working through the offseason in the summer. I guess, you know, the only question left to hit is inevitably whenever one of these big programs doesn't necessarily, you know, reach as far as people might think. You heard a lot of it after Syracuse, you know, missed the Division I playoffs back in 2007. You know, was oh, is this the end of the Syracuse dynasty? Is the field caught up to them? All that kind of stuff. And then lo and behold, they win the 2008-2009 championship. You know, obviously Berkman gets this team to, you know, to this Final Four. He, you know, ends the year still 11 games above 500. So it's not nearly the same comparison. But, I mean, do we take anything from this season in terms of, you know, the parity argument, the fact that there are a lot more or good chunks of the Division III world now are starting to catch up to where Salisbury has been for so long?
I don't know if it's so much that. It's kind of what I mentioned earlier, is that, you know, so much of Salisbury's success has come from, you know, one guy and then a lot of 1A-type players. You know, you have your star in Bradman or Kyler Berkman, and then you surround them with other just deadly, deadly scorers who, when they have, you know, a foot, an extra couple of inches of space because the star players attract, you know, an extra stick, they're just able to bury it. That didn't happen today, and or this year for Salisbury. They didn't have that type of player. And Berkman throughout the season mentioned that, you know, there was no type Sam Bradman type player in D3 this season. You know, if Brady DeShield is able to make you know, a huge leap and become that type of guy next year, and even if not, I think Salisbury will be the team to look out for next year in D3. You know, Stevenson, I'm sure they're going to be right back up there again. They're always tough, and you know the usual suspects will be there as well. You know, the Cortlands of the world. But I think Salisbury will probably go in as, if not the favorite for next year, definitely in the conversation as one of the top teams in Division III.
All right, well, Sean, thank you very much for coming on and, you know, kind of giving a recap, a little bit of a. You know, it was of note. Anytime Salisbury does anything in the Division III world, it tends to make waves. So I thought it was of note to kind of look at this season for them that was a little atypical, but in the end, maybe not that much so, considering how deep into the playoffs they got again. I mean, the one thing you know about Salisbury is they're going to be making noise in May. It just kind of depends on how long, if they get to have the last word or one of the last one, I guess, along the trip here. So enjoy this, and I guess you don't have to worry about a trip to Philly this weekend, so
yep.
Enjoy your time out on the Eastern Shore.
Yeah, no cheesesteak for me, unfortunately. That's okay. Zach, thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it.
No problem, Sean. Take care. So the championship game is set May 26th at 4 p.m. RIT takes on Stevenson at Lincoln Financial Field in Philadelphia. Be sure to follow Inside Lacrosse all weekend for all breaking news from the championships in D1, D2, and D3, as well as complete coverage of the women's championship in nearby Villanova. As always, stay tuned to InsideLacrosse.com and search the iTunes store under Inside Lacrosse for more of our pretty much daily new podcasts these days. And stay tuned to InsideLacrosse.com all weekend for coverage of not just the end of the collegiate season, but continued coverage of the MLL. I'm aiming to bring you a second D3 podcast later in the week, kind of looking forward at this championship game between Stevenson and RIT. I think it'll be a really fun contest to watch. I mean, we can try and get into some of the matchups and the details that'll probably wind up deciding this contest in the end. As always, any thoughts or questions about the podcast, feel free to email me, zbabo@insidelacrosse.com. That's zbabo@insidelacrosse.com. You can follow me on Twitter, @ZachBabo, that's @ZACHBABO, no spaces. Thanks again for listening, and let's get ready for championship weekend here.